Welcome to the Power Hour. I'm Adrienne Herbert, wellness coach, international speaker, and author. Each week, I speak to a variety of guests, from business founders to Olympic athletes, leading coaches, change makers, and innovators, to find out their daily habits, their rules to live by, and what motivates them to get up out of bed each day. Personally, I am on a mission to encourage, motivate, and inspire, so I hope that the Power Hour will help you to achieve your personal and professional goals. Welcome back to the podcast. Today, I'm joined by George Lamb. Now, you'll probably know George from radio, from TV. He's previously presented shows such as Big Brother's Little Brother and The Bank Job, as well as hosting on BBC Radio and TalkSport. But what you might not know is that for the last few years, George has been working on a number of different projects and pursuing his passion for sustainability. Today, he's working with farmers, businesses, charities and organisations to fix food and fix the planet. George, welcome to the podcast.
How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, I'm great. Thank you. Excited to be here. I've just been away for a few days, so I feel revitalized, re-energized, and yeah, good to go.
Great. Yeah, I've got loads of things to talk to you about today. And I guess in my brief introduction, I mentioned, you know, some people might know you from TV, know you from radio, and they might not be familiar with the work that you've been doing more recently. And I think that, you know, career change or lifestyle change is, it's been a hot topic for a long time, but especially post-pandemic, you know, a lot of people have kind of reassessed and reevaluated their lives and thought, actually, do I want to do something different, or can I see myself doing this, you know, forever? And so I talk on this podcast about creating change and not being afraid of it, whether that is career, lifestyle, or something different. And that is something that you have done yourself. And I'm sure that it probably presented challenges along the way. So I'd love it if you could take us back, you know, take us back a few years. You've got this great career in radio and TV, you know, fame and celebrity status and all of its perks. And what was it, I guess, then that initially made you want to make a change to your career? And was it a gradual thing, or was it one day light bulb moment and a kind of impulsive change?
So where to begin? My mum's an entrepreneur and had many different businesses when I was growing up. She's, you know, she's a serial entrepreneur. And my dad is an actor. So I never grew up in a house where there was a kind of regularity and a rhythm to how people went to work and what they did, you know. And I wasn't coming from the same start point as most people, you know. And I went to college. I went to sixth form college. I wasn't really crazy about school. I just, you know, I didn't really. It wasn't the right time for me. I'd love it now. And so I knew I didn't want to go to university. I met a fella at college. He was like, we were crazy about dance music at the time. And he said to me, I want to be a kind of DJ and producer. And I was like, great, I'll be your manager. And so that was my first kind of, and I'd all sort, you know, I had all the, like, you know, every Saturday job you can imagine growing up. But then that was my first real gig. And I spent the first, I don't know, 7 years of my, professional career as a band manager. And it went quite well for a while. The main guys that I managed were these guys, the Audio Bullies, and we had a moment and travelled all over the world, and it was great fun. Perhaps a little bit too hedonistic, and when we were in our kind of mid 20s, it all started to sour a little bit, and I was looking for something else to do, and I just kind of happened upon working in television. I was renting a desk from a guy who had a TV company whilst I was still a band manager. For the first 2 years of doing presenting, I just say to people, like, I'm a band manager, but I'm actually doing a bit of presenting just to, you know, figure out what it is I'm going to do in my life, you know, what I'm doing next, and or waiting to find the next artist or whatever it was. I don't know what story I was telling myself, but anyway, I kind of pivoted into that. You know, so I didn't grow up thinking I was desperate to be a TV presenter, and because my dad's career had really kind of faltered a lot in my kind of formative years of when I was making decisions about what I was going to do for a job, I I definitely knew I didn't want to go into or be, you know, like, kind of, you know, in front of the camera. That's what I thought anyway. And then the next thing you know, I'm you know, trying out as a TV presenter. I got quite, you know, I found it quite easy. It came to me naturally. I got quite lucky. I got a really good agent. He was very pushy and powerful at this particular moment. And my career kind of got fast tracked. And all of a sudden I was on telly and radio and all the rest of it, you know, all the time, basically. And it was all going very well. But if you follow, but you know, because I didn't really have, there was no real kind of purpose, or like, I didn't come from a, you know, speciality background. So I wasn't, you know, a historian or, a, you know, I'm trying to think what other things, or a chef, or, you know, like coming from a specific, you know, background, you end up becoming a kind of jack of all trades. And if you follow the money, which is, you know, what, you know, every kid who grows up in the 80s, who's, you know, like coming off the vapors of Thatcherism, is, you know, taught that you just got to get out there and get your money up and you know, be successful. I followed the money, and then the next thing you know, I found myself, I was a game show host, you know. And so, as you previously mentioned, you know, as you know, comes with that is a lot of, you know, it's fun, and there's lots of nice trappings, and there's money, and there's adulation and attention and all of the stuff that you think that you really want. I didn't get to the top, but I got to the kind of, you know, top of the middle, maybe. So I had a good look at it, and I went to all the parties, and I bought all the stuff, and I was making a really good living, but it just wasn't making my heart sing at all, and I felt kind of empty. And so I'd run this whole trope that when I got onto primetime television, I was going to be really happy. Obviously, finally made it onto primetime television, and then actually, like, nothing changes. You're just working at a different time of day. And I woke up and had a very, you know, like, you know, obviously it sounds a bit cliche, but I had this conversation. I remember having it, you know, I was lying in bed in my house. We'd just done the second series of this show, The Bank Job, which was on, you know, Friday and Saturday nights at 9 o'clock on Channel 4. And my face was on the side of the bus, and I was earning lots of money, and, you know, everything's great. And everybody's telling me how well I'm doing, and that I'm smashing it and all the rest of it. And I rang my dad. And I was just like, Dad, I don't know what's going on, but I don't feel happy, and I just feel really empty, and I've got all this stuff, and everybody's telling me how well I'm doing, and, like, I know I shouldn't feel, you know, I feel I don't want to feel ungrateful, but, like, I'm just, it's not doing it for me. And he was like, well, you know, I was like, what? He's like, game show host. I was like, right? He's like, not a very serious guy in the big scheme of things, is he? You know? And I was just like,
wow. Such is that.
Yeah, I was like, you know, you definitely could have told me that, you know, 5-10 years ago or whatever. And he was like, well, you're having a really good run at it, you know? Yeah. And so, you know, I just started to kind of, you know, I was reevaluating, you know, who I was and what I was doing in my life and what my contribution was beyond just kind of orbiting my own ego. And I think because I'd been lucky, you know, the band I managed, we'd got signed when we were really young. We got signed when we were 21. So, like, 21 to 25, we were having, you know, we'd had 3 awful years beforehand where we'd almost given up, you know, about 4 or 5 times, and then just finally just kind of hung on in there. And our mates were actually coming back from university and like, oh, how's it going, guys? Not working, is it? You know? And we were like, oh, fuck, what are we going to do? And then it finally took off. And so I had quite a lot of success. Basically, my 20s was, from a kind of commercial and cultural perspective, was very successful. And so I think I was kind of fast-tracked. By the time I was in my early 30s, I was kind of having my midlife crisis, basically, and that search for meaning that everybody comes to, hopefully, at some point.
Yeah, as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, gosh, there's so many questions and so many things, I guess, that I wanted to maybe just jump in and touch on. One is when you said about quote-unquote successful, you know, and however you define that, but as you've described, you know, having a lot of success. And you said, I didn't get to the top, but I got to the top of the middle. And you know what? It's such an interesting concept. I was talking to a friend literally yesterday about this idea of the success trap and this idea that, you know, when you have success, however you define that, you then face a host of new challenges because the stakes are higher and it becomes like this constant strive for more, you know, get on the next bigger TV show, or, you know, if you're a best-selling author, you know, write another book and that's got to be a bestseller, or, you know, the next thing's got to be more money and bigger and better and on and on. And so this success trap as we know, some of the most quote unquote successful people that we know, especially in that kind of, I think, young, early 30s age, are the most dissatisfied. They're the most, you know, they feel like whatever they're doing, it's not enough, because as you said, you can look to that, the bigger mountain, the mountain next to the one you're standing on the top of, and you can see other people doing, you know, the next thing or the bigger thing. And if you never define success, and if you never define enough, then you never actually realize if you're living it right now. Do you know what I mean? You might be right now today living your dream job or your dream life, but suddenly that's no longer enough. And it's this really, I don't know how, you know, you break that trap, but do you feel like that ladder, or like kind of that analogy there, is where you were at? And I think for a lot of people who might be thinking that's where they're at right now, how did you, I guess, have the courage actually to make a change when you're successful, when you're succeeding, it's all going good. So why change?
I think you're bang on with that kind of analogy of you've just climbed up this amazing mountain and you've done a great job and you're up there, and then you look across and you're like, oh shit, I need to get up that one, you know? And it's like, where does it end? I've actually been, you know, reflecting on it a lot recently. I've been trying to figure out where this thing comes from, because, you know, like this thing of nothing ever being good enough, you know, like I've got a business now, we're a team of maybe 25 and I'm trying to, you know, lead them as best I can. And so, like, how do you, you know, how hard are you on people, and how much do you push people, and how much do you set everybody, you know, set the kind of barometer by your own pace and what you think is good enough? And then I realized that actually through never being, never taking stock and never being happy with where I was at, and really sitting and kind of congratulating myself and being kind to myself, I never really kind of enjoyed all the success I was having. I definitely enjoyed it when we were doing the band stuff. But then maybe there was a bit of me that was like, I've enjoyed it too much, and now it's all crumbled. So maybe I need to just really have this kind of stoicism as I'm going through the next bit of it, you know? So my family's from the East Coast of Scotland. My dad's from London, but my mum's from the East Coast of Scotland. And they're like heavy duty Presbyterian, like not my family particularly, but just the whole, like, culturally up there, like the highest compliment you can pay anybody is that he's an awfully hard worker. Yeah, he's a really hard worker. That's that is the highest of highest praise, you know? And so this thing of just like this constant drive and pushing and like, basically I've realized now that nothing was ever good enough for my mum. So I don't know whether that came from my granddad or came from my granny, or like, and how they pushed it onto my mum and then her pushing it onto me, and then trying to break down, like, there's something amazing about this constant striving and pushing, and actually, like, maybe what's afforded me the success that I've had is this wanting to kick on all the time.
Well, I think a lot of people can relate to that as well, because of course that is what, for some people, they'd say, well, actually, if I take that away, would I have achieved so much? Would I have had, as you say, the drive, the work ethic? And another thing you mentioned before was about feeling ungrateful. And I think a lot of people can probably relate to that, saying, oh, poor you, you know, you've had all this success and, you know, you thought it was going to make you happy and it didn't. And like you said, there's a reason that you said cliche. There's a reason cliches have become cliches. When people say, oh, you know, the richest people aren't happy, and everyone says, well, if you haven't got any money, you think, well, of course, you know, poor you. There's very little empathy. And I think that's where, as you said about being kind to yourself, if we can't really allow ourselves to feel whatever the feeling is. So, for example, that feeling of ungratefulness. I have that often. I'll think, you know, oh, come on, Adrienne, you can't be ungrateful. You've just got to be glad that you're doing this thing. And I think there's a real balance there between being appreciative of the opportunities, of the work, of the situation that you're in, even with the challenges, even with the problems. I often say, you know, I'm lucky to have these problems. So if it's a problem that you're trying to work out, especially with my career, I'll be like, this is lucky you that you have this problem. But, you know, this problem to solve, let's say you've got two choices and two opportunities on the table, and you can only do one. It's like, oh, you know, what a great problem to have. But I think this idea of feeling ungrateful and feeling like you can't complain, you can't, you know, it's great that you, of course, had that conversation with your dad where you could be honest and say to him, you know what, I don't want this. And I can, you know, you can change and allow yourself, I suppose, give yourself the permission to just look around and go, actually, you know, maybe this is what I wanted, but maybe things are different now and I want something else.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I was in a very privileged position that I didn't really have any dependents, you know, so, and I hadn't, you know, I didn't have kids who I'd put into private school or have a, you know, have a kind of standard of living that my family had come to expect and so on and so forth. So me kind of like throwing, you know, renouncing all worldly goods and selling my house and getting rid of all my stuff and going off and, you know, doing all the, you know, going off in the, you know, the man's search for meaning, I was able to do that because really I was beholden only to myself, you know.
So what was that like? You sold your house, you gave up your things, and where did you go? What was the plan?
I basically just went off for a couple of years and followed my nose and just went wherever, you know, like I'd meet some people, they'd tell me about somewhere cool or they'd tell me about something cool that was happening. And then I just, you know, I was doing like really bougie traveling, basically, like a gap year, you know.
Festivals.
Festivals, but also just like staying in nice, you know, I'd made money so I could go and stay in nice places, you know, and then, and I might go and rough it for a bit and then, and just take a, you know, and go and take a little cabin on a beach in the middle of nowhere. And then I'd, you know, and then I'd come back into the city and stay somewhere nice and plug into the nightlife. And, you know, and I was trying, you know, I got into plant medicine for a bit and I got into, you know, I was reading everything I could, anything I could read about spirituality and about personal development, I guess, really, actually, you know, consuming as much of that as I possibly could, all the podcasts, all the documentaries, all the books, whatever, you know, going to retreats, spending time around people who, you know, hopefully were a bit further along the kind of learning journey. So could, you know, help me fast track stuff. And then actually came back to the UK and did therapy 3 days a week for 6 months.
Wow.
Actually probably got me, like, that was the bit that actually really progressed me more than the going off and, you know, knocking around in the woods and all the rest of it.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think a lot of people, if they could, I'm sure, would love to think, wow, that sounds amazing. Go off and, as you said, have the freedom to, you know, explore, find new people, new places, just being exposed sometimes to change and to what's possible. And like you said, reading every self-development book, you know, listening to podcasts. But it's really interesting that you said, actually, you know, nothing can replace therapy. And I think sometimes people think that they can do it all on their own. You know, we buy all these books about this guru, that, and this happiness, that, and this finance guru. And it's, you know, look for someone to tell you what to do, and then you can do it all on your own. But I actually think, yeah, there's a huge takeaway there about actually asking for help, receiving help, the accountability of working with a professional therapist.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people now are trying to replace therapy just with, you know, motivational quotes on Instagram. And actually it's not going to do it, right? Therapy's hard work.
Therapy's hard work, and I think
doing that work for 6 months is really, really hard. So you did that, and talk to us about, I guess, from then to now.
So I come back, I do the therapy, and then I can see I've probably been kind of on the road, you know, on the road-ish for a couple of years, maybe pushing 3 years, and I can see that the money's going to run out, basically, because it wasn't like I planned this whole thing, like go in, earn X amount, you know, plan the whole thing, buy some properties, do whatever. I just went in, earned money, lived a high life, you know, living beyond my means for sure. And so when I quit, I didn't actually have all that much money. And so I could see that was running out. And I was like, right, I need to go and do something. And my mate called me and he said, I'm opening a restaurant in Ibiza. And we'd actually, before I'd got into television, we had this dream of doing a beach club together. And I didn't get in on the beach club. And it turned out to be the most successful beach club in Ibiza, basically. And so he was like, I'm going to do another one. I'm like, I'm coming. Just like, wait for me. We went to Ibiza. The restaurant turned into the nightmare of all nightmares, but it taught me a hell of a lot about myself. And in that one night, I went into a club and I met this fella called Andy Cato, who's now my business partner. And Andy was one half of Groove Armada. And we just started having a chat. And I said, what you been up to? And he said that he'd sold his publishing rights to Groove Armada and he bought 100-hectare farm down in Gascony. And he was going to try and figure out how you do wheat production properly. And obviously, of all that, if I'd have picked 5,000, you know, conversations that I thought I was going to have in space that night, that wouldn't have been one of them. And I was just like, right, what are you talking about? That's really interesting. And he, as I've come to find, is, you know, he's the best man I know by you know, some distance, and you know, his integrity, you know, level 10. And so when somebody tells you their truth and you see the conviction in their eyes, and I think actually retrospectively, when I think about what my, you know, I heard you talk on one of your podcasts talking about your superpower being the ability to ask the right question, or and you know when to ask and who to ask and what to ask. I think my superpower is I'm able to see genius, and then I'm able to get behind it really quickly and really like and give myself over to it, and then in me giving myself over to it, I can be very compelling and convincing to be the amplifier for that thing, you know. And I've done it multiple times through my career. For me, that conviction of selling what is effectively your pension as a musician, and they came around, you know, they did well, but they came before the crazy money came into dance music. So this wasn't a, like, you know, he was spending, you know, one tenth of this huge amount of money or whatever. This was literally the whole family silver going on this farm. Like, if it doesn't work, they're bankrupt, you know. And I really resonate with that, with people who just, you know, like put their money where their mouth is. And so he and I were meeting throughout the summer. At that point, basically, he bought the farm, it was all going wrong, and he was coming, he was doing like smash and grab every week, coming to Ibiza to earn money to prop up this farming disaster that he'd created, basically. And so I was meeting him every week and finding out more about it, and I was just like, wow, maybe this is, you know, I've been looking when I was off in the, you know, mountains and jungle and all the rest of it. I was looking for a guru, basically, didn't find it, and now all of a sudden I found him in Ibiza in a nightclub, you know. And I'm like, right, this is my guy. And so at the end of the summer, I drove back through Spain, and he lived at that point just over the border in France, southwestern France. Went to the farm, saw what he was doing, and pretty much then and there just said, right, listen, I'm with you. I don't know what I can do, but I can help, you know, and I can bring noise and energy to this thing. So like, let's do something. And then that's been a very, you know, it's been a long, you know, it's been a long process and been a slow burn. That was probably 10 years ago now.
Wow, okay.
I'll just jump back a little bit here. Andy was the one who kind of pivoted me into thinking about nature. I'd seen the kind of excesses and the nonsense that is show business. The big, like, kind of, like, the kind of Damascene moment for me in changing my life was off the back of the London riots, or the riots that happened in the UK. And I remember, like, at this moment in time when you just saw, you know, basically all young people were just, or a lot of young people were out on the street, and they were just smashing stuff up, and it was just kind of anarchic, and there wasn't really any real focus for what was going on, and basically people had just had enough. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I realized that my role as a game show host was basically as a pacifier, you know, because what had become very apparent to me was when I'd go into social circles where I was in rooms full of really wealthy people, nobody, and you know, when you're like, you know, well known or whatever, you know, in the public eye, you know, when people recognize you or not, you know, you've got a good radar for it. And when I go into a room full of wealthy people, nobody had any idea who I was, right? And when I went into a room full of working class people, everybody knew everything about me. They knew everything about my dad and our family and all the rest of it. And they're going, how you doing, Georgie? What's going on? How's the old man? La, 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 la. And so what I realized was that I had somehow found my way into making television that's basically distraction. And so whilst the wealthy people are out there carving up the world for themselves, all the rest of the people, the majority of the people, are sitting at home eating Doritos, watching a telly that they don't, you know, that they haven't paid off, in a flat that they don't own, sitting there going like, oh, I'd like to win £1,000, you know. And I'm there in a, you know, £2,000 suit going, oh, you know, like, you know, pick box number three, you know, let's see what happens, you know. And because I sound the way I sound, they feel an affinity towards me and they feel like I'm one of them, but really I wasn't one of them. And I'd gone off and I'd managed to get myself into the, like, you know, not the 1%, but whatever, into the kind of that tiny minority of people who basically got it all their own way. And so I just realized at that point, I was like, wow, there's two worlds going on here. And I, as a kind of middle ranking television personality, I am living a completely, like, detached, like, life experience to what the majority of people are living. Like, God only knows what that's like for, like, really wealthy politicians who've grown up with, you know, in a privileged background and then gone on to become Prime Minister. David Cameron at that point was Prime Minister. And I was just like, he's not got the playbook. Like, he doesn't have the tools to sort this stuff out. Like, and then I was like, shit, like, who's going to sort this stuff out? And then and at that point, I was just looking outwardly, like, who's doing it? Who's doing it? And then I have this kind of realization that actually, like, maybe I've got to do it. And maybe I've got to be part, or I've got to have some collective social responsibility, and not just expect, like, well, I pay my taxes, so everything should be sorted. Like, it just doesn't work like that, you know? And so for the first time in my life, I was like, shit, something beyond just the end of my nose is, like, you know, like is actually in my jurisdiction, you know? And I've got to try and do something about that. And so I started doing all this community work, and I was working a lot of the time with Kid Company, who are an amazing charity, and that's another whole story, but... Anyway, I was working with them, and they were literally just like holding like London together. They had 5,000 kids on their books, basically 500 key workers. And then they got bombed out and you know, shut down within 2 weeks. And then, you know, London's been in free fall since then, basically. But what I realized through doing that work was, you know, effectively, you know, like, or metaphorically speaking, there's a never ending stream of half dead bodies coming down the river, you know, and you can pull them out and put a blanket on them, give them a cup of tea. And then you turn around, there's another 5 and another 10, another 5. And there's absolute merit in getting the people out of the water and putting the blanket on them. But that's not for me. I want to go upstream, and I want to see what the problem is, and I want to see how you solve it, and I will see how you potentially might be able to solve it. And that brought me to education. And so I was like, right, how are we going to, if you're going to change things at a systems level, you need to get into education, basically. Mm. Okay, here we go. Maybe this is what I'm meant to be doing. Turned out a friend of mine had just got his headship of a big secondary school, comprehensive school up in North London. So I started hanging around the school a lot and just trying to figure out where I fit in with it all. And I was like, right, you know, do I get my artist friends up and music friends up? And we do lots of kind of cool creative projects. But like, what does that really do? What does that really change? And then obviously all the Andy stuff's kicking along in the background, and every time I'm going over and having like kind of bus, you know, working holidays where I go and just work on the farm, but I wasn't really joining the dots up.
I think the thread that I'm hearing through a lot of this as well is about this desire for contribution. You know, you mentioned it a few times around, okay, well, good for me if I'm doing well, but what is this really all about? And, you know, that search for meaning, as you said, and purpose. And, you know, I think that thread of contribution is something that I do think at some point in all of our lives, we will face that, you know, that challenge, that question, whether it's for 5 minutes for some people or whether it's for 5 years of exploration, because I do think that innately with us, you know, human nature, we want to create things, we want to produce things, we want to do things that not only serve ourselves but also serve other people, serve the collective, serve the tribe, the group, whatever that is. So do you feel like, yeah, maybe that search for, okay, how am I contributing, what am I contributing, do you think that service of others piece is something that you were, I suppose, searching for, that you've now found with the projects you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how. I mean, I was really lucky, you know. Like, I got sent off to like I went to my local primary school, and then I got sent off to this kind of like mad. My mum was quite kind of alternative and hippie when I was in my, you know, when I was coming into my teens, and I got sent off to this really alternative progressive school that was it was you know, founded by Quakers, and it was vegetarian, and it was no school uniform, and it was. And it was, you know, like no religion, and just and like super artistic and interesting and all the rest of it. And I don't know why, I just didn't connect with it in the way that I could have and I should have. And I just was really focused on getting, basically wanting to get money and at all costs. And so I don't know what, like the only kind of really like constant thing with me was just like, you've got to go and get money. I suppose also, like, my dad, you know, like, an actor's life is boom and bust, basically, unless you're mega, mega successful. And so we'd have all these times, we were never like, we weren't like poor or anything, but we were just, it fluctuated all the time. So sometimes we had loads of money, and then sometimes we had literally nothing, you know?
That creates that scarcity, doesn't it? The scarcity mindset, which is that actually, if you do have a parent who has a job like that, as you say, boom and bust, boom and and bust, then it can often, I think, make your mindset around money. It's no wonder actually that you were like, okay, I've got to have money because it could be taken away, or, you know, maybe you've got to save for that rainy day, or you might have a lot and then suddenly it's gone. So I think that idea of actually, yeah, pursuing money. I mean, there's a lot of reasons people pursue money. Let's be honest. You know, we live in a capitalist world. Like, you know, I think a lot of people would be very dishonest if they said that they didn't pursue money. A lot of people do that. And even, you know, just when you describe the school that you went to, I don't know, often we just want to rebel against what our parents, you know, if our parents are super strict, then maybe we're more reckless. Or if our parents are really hippie and alternative, maybe we seek convention. Like, you know, often there's so many things that go on. But I think this kind of, yeah, I don't know, this idea that actually if you had that experience of boom and bust, then actually it's, yeah, probably quite natural that you would pursue stability and money, which ironically you're saying that you didn't do, because you're like, yeah, I had loads of money, but I just spent it and then, you know, kind of went off around the world without a plan. So yeah, lots of I don't know, it's very interesting. We all, I guess, can do that introspective reflection, but I guess it's brought you now to, yeah, to the wonderful work that you're doing. And I actually want to get into that actually. And for people who are listening who don't know, can you tell us about the wild farming and grow and yeah, that's essentially what it's all about?
Yeah, so as it stands, they're two separate things. In the end, I hope they'll become one thing, basically. But yeah, basically, I've met Andy. He's got me starting to think about nature in the bigger picture, like as a bit of a background. My mum's a gardener in her later years, and she's always, I'm going off doing ayahuasca, and she's like, you don't need to do an ayahuasca, you just need to grow a garden, and like all the answers you'll ever need are there, like stop being an idiot. I'm doing community work. I'm feeling that I'm not getting that much from it, or the fact that it's kind of like it's futile almost, and I'm like, how do we change things? Like, what's the one irrefutable thing that binds us all together? And I'm like, it's our mutual dependence on the well-being of the planet, basically, you know? And so I'm like, right, where have we gone wrong? If you can really like plot it on the map, like where have we gone wrong as a species? We're in this cult of the individual. We're in this thing. We're all pursuing money. We're in this thing where we're not worried about like anybody else, and at all costs, basically. And so I'm like, we've forgotten that we're actually part of something bigger, and we're part of, you know, that we're actually part of nature. And I think that's the point. If you chart on the line, the bit where we separated from nature and we stopped realizing that we were part of a functioning kind of ecosystem, and we thought that we were a bit better and bigger than it, I think that's when things really started to go wrong with us as a kind of species. And so I was like, right, how do you regulate that? I read a book, which now obviously we see it every day in the newspapers and on the news and all the rest of it. But like, this was 5 years ago. It's called How Soon Is Now? And it's about the ecological mega crisis. This is pre-XR, pre-Greta. I sat and I read the book in a day, and I was just like, whoa, like, oh shit. If we don't like radically change the way we're behaving, we're all finished.
How soon is now? So how soon is now? So yeah, what was the key takeaway from that book for you?
There is an impending ecological mega crisis, and if we don't change our behavior, we'll get wiped off the planet. That's the crib sheet from it, basically. And so I'm like, okay, so like, how do you raise the environmental literacy of a generation like super rapid? You got to set up Jedi training camps in schools, basically, and get everybody's, you know, get everybody's environmental literacy, but also their EQ, because all we've been doing for the last however many years is just concentrating on IQ, and actually our emotional intelligence is what's going to get us through this thing. You know, there's loads of incredibly, incredibly smart, in, you know, but academic smart people who've just, you know, and a lot of whom are now running the world, and they don't have any empathy and they don't have any emotional intelligence. And so if you don't find the sweet spot between the two, we just end up in this kind of winner takes all mess that we're living in now, basically.
Yeah. I think the hard thing with future, you know, catastrophe or whatever, you would, these things that you said about empathy, it's very hard to empathize with something that's not going to affect you. And whether that's because you've, you know, socioeconomically, whether that's because you've got loads of money and so the cost of living crisis doesn't really impact you that much if your energy bill increases, or whether it's saying, yeah, actually this is going to happen in 40 years, and someone who's maybe 65 is thinking, okay, it's not going to impact me. Yeah, exactly. And so I think this idea of, you know, EQ for causes and for purpose and for things that actually might not impact you, maybe it'll impact your kids or your grandkids. Is that why you wanted to kind of go after the younger generation? I've heard you talk about this before, you know, this next generation of eco warriors, and let's empower them with knowledge and create these like eco ninjas. So yeah, what's the response been like from the young people that you work with?
Yeah, well, I think just to your point there, or to your question, that the changing adults is nigh on impossible. You know, the majority of people, short of the building being on fire, it's very hard to get people to go in the same direction at the same time, you know? And so, like, trying to get people to unravel years of you know, kind of patterns of consumption and belief systems and all the rest of it, like, I haven't got the energy for it, and I think it's futile, basically. So I'm like, you just got to go after young people. Young people get programmed, you know, young people can be programmed, basically. I think that we're living in a system where, unfortunately, we've got a really outmoded and outdated education system, and I think that we need to change that. And I think that that these kids are sponges, and they have the ability to you know, humans are amazing, and our capacity to learn and the like network effect and you know, kind of like how things move exponentially, I think it's miraculous. And so, but we're just not feeding the right stuff into the system. And so I started this organization called Grow probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago now, and we've been piloting up at a school in North London. We're just starting to do other projects around the place, but we've been piloting up there for a while. And basically, our whole thing was about connection, and connection to nature, and connection to community, and connection to place and self, really, you know. So that's been the focus. We when it started, and you know, who knows, we might go back to it, but when it started, we broke it into like three different categories. So the kids would do kind of 6 week rotations, and we had all of the first 2 years of secondary school were going through it. So we had about 300 kids a week lockdown. We had about 300 kids a week going through it, and they do 6 weeks of ground, which was getting the kids outside and getting their hands dirty and teaching them how to grow their own food. And then they have 6 weeks of flow, which is about how do you get into flow state, into your optimum, you know, frequency. So that might be yoga, breath work, meditation, you know, mindfulness stuff. And then we do 6 weeks of think, and we do that with the British Philosophical Society. So getting kids, you know, how do you feel and what do you think about things, rather than just looking for this linear route to yes all the time and being petrified and no, and like all the creative, critical, expansive thinking gets battered out of kids when they go to school, unfortunately, in the mainstream system. And so you just get a load of, you know, like minds, in my opinion, like brains aren't there to remember stuff, you know, like brains are there to learn how to think, how to develop ideas, how to express ideas, how to exchange and build on stuff together. And unfortunately, we're still running on an old setting, you know, like we've got incredibly...
George, you are speaking my language. Honestly, I have this conversation frequently as a mother to an 11-year-old who's just started secondary school, and this idea of exactly what you said, you know, learn something is remember it and then write it down and tick a box, when actually I try and say to my son all the time, once you learn how to learn, it is so much more important than what you learn. Yeah. Because essentially I learned how to learn as an adult. And I think, you know, my voracious learning, reading, listening, that came later in my life. And actually, I think once I figured out how I learn, oh my gosh, it was such an unlock for me. It changed everything. So I really, really, yeah, like this idea that actually grow, flow and think. And actually, what is think? You know, how do we solve problems? How do we, yeah, be creative in it? And if you're not, I don't know, academic, book smart as a young person, that does not mean that you are, you know, that you're not smart, or that you can't innovate or create or build, you know, be the next, I don't know, whatever you want to be. But yeah, it's a real one that I mean, we could do a whole episode, I'm sure, just talking about that. But I think it's great that, you know, for some kids, they access Maybe they access it through sport. Maybe they access it through a program like yours or through an internship, or apprenticeship, something. But I just hope that, yeah, people will hear that, especially when they're working with young people or if they're parents, to know there are so many different things we need to consider when it comes to, yeah, encouraging people to think and to rethink and to learn. So big fan of that. Big fan.
Good. Great.
back to the Grow program after that aside.
So, yeah, so I suppose, you know, ultimately what we're trying to do with Grow is figure out how you change the school, how you change the education system. And I mean, we're not, you know, it's a long and winding road, and it'll probably be my life's work, to be totally honest with you. And I realized, you know, like, it was really tiring. I basically tried to kind of take on, you know, I had a really great team of people who were hired, and our pilot project, is up at a school called the Totteridge Academy, and a really dear friend of mine is head teacher there. And we had a lot of, you know, like, the wind was in our sails a lot of the time, but trying to basically go up against the system is quite exhausting. You know, like, I suppose I'm just, I've stepped back a little bit, and I'm re-evaluating and rethinking how best to approach it. And like, this, you know, the North Star is still the North Star, but like, how we get there, maybe I'm going to, you know, think differently about that.
Well, it's great, because as we've discussed throughout this entire episode, you know, change, innovation is something that I, you know, do a lot within the work that I do with startups or companies. You know, I'm often thinking about future and innovation and some of the things that we're going to need to tackle some of the biggest problems that lie ahead. You know, there's a lot of smart people working on it, as you said, but there's also each of us as individuals and what we can do and what we can contribute. So yeah, I wish you a lot of success with it. I hope, you know, I'll be looking and watching the journey, and I hope that it's gonna do what it needs to do for you as an individual, but also the impact that you want it to have.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
And so on a more personal note, I guess, you know, I'm very interested in what makes people do what they do each day. You know, what motivates them to get up every day. I always say that time is the most valuable thing we have. And often we'll say we don't have enough time, but in fact, it's that we waste so much of it. So, George, I'd love to talk to you about the concept of the Power Hour. Are you familiar with the Power Hour concept? You've listened to the show
it.
Before.
Yeah,
yeah. So indeed. Can you tell us about the first hour of your day, what it typically includes, and what time does your day start?
So I've been actually, I was thinking about this before I knew I was coming on the show, because I'm a morning person, and my most productive time is when I first wake up. Like, I wake up and I'm on. And then gradually I become less and less effective throughout the day, basically. and unfortunately, my girlfriend, she is the polar opposite, basically. Like, she doesn't get going till kind of lunchtime, and then like her real sharp hours are like just as I'm starting to doze off, you know. So we really definitely are kind of ships in the night. But the first bit of my day would always be my really productive bit. I'd go off, I'd go for a run, I'd start thinking about things, I'd come back, I'd jot stuff down, I'd be making voice notes as I was running, because I'd be panicking, I was never going to be able to remember that thing. And now basically my waking hours are dominated by our dog. And when I get up, he gets up, and then he needs feeding, and then that's the bit where he really wants to engage like that. And he's kind of, we've got a very kind of funny dog. He was born, he was the runt of 12. He really didn't look like he was going to make it. He was born with one eye. You know, all the dog trainers in London were like, it doesn't work, you know, I don't know what you're going to do with it, kind of thing. And so he's you know, he's a special guy, basically. And the only time he really wants to connect with me is in the morning. And the last dog trainer we had, and when we were like literally pulling our hair out, she said to me, listen, the sooner you recognize that this guy's your guide and he's not your pet, your life's going to get a lot easier. And I was just like, oh, for fuck's sake, how have I ended up with this guy as my guide? Anyway.
You were looking for a guru. You got one.
I was looking for a guru, exactly. You know, so I've got a one-eyed Welsh hound now who's my guru. But anyway, that's the moment where he wants to get into it. And so I have this constant kind of push-pull because I'm like, dude, like this is my bit. Like this is the bit when I'm really good and I'm powerful and I can make stuff happen. I'm highly effective. And like, you just want me to like rub you and like full body massage you. And then we've got to go to the same boring park again, you know, like, and then so now I take my rope out there. I do this thing called, I mean, like I'm amateur level, but this thing called Weigh the Rope. I don't know if you've ever come across it. It's really amazing movement stuff. Yeah. And so I take my rope and so I try and get my body moving a bit and I'll stretch a bit when I'm out there on the field with him. If I try and run, he's not into that at all, basically. So,
I love this. I've interviewed a lot of people, George. I've done a lot of interviews on this show. I've heard so many people talk about their power hour. And honestly, I feel like I've never heard a power hour like this. It's basically dictated by your one-eyed dog.
By a dog, yeah. And it's chaos. So I just try and fit in around him, basically. And maybe that's teaching me a load of stuff. I don't know. Maybe that's going to prepare me for fatherhood and all the rest of it.
Oh, it definitely will. That is something, I mean, the word chaos and fatherhood, you know, when people talk about having young children and, you know, they're like power hour, they're just like, I'm up at 3, I'm up at 4, I'm up at 5, I'm up at 6. So yes, I think it will definitely prepare you, maybe teach you to embrace chaos, to go with the flow, patience. Let's be honest, when you've got, when you're doing things for other people's on other people's time, it requires a whole new level of patience. So I'm sure there's a lot of lessons there in your power hour that you're learning from him.
No doubt. But I hope so. Otherwise, it'll all be in vain. You know what I mean? It's got to be a two-way street, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I wish we could talk for longer because I've still got questions. I've still got things to think and talk about. But I really appreciate you coming onto the show, being so honest and candid. And I'm sure the listeners are going to enjoy hearing your story as much as I have. So thank you, George.
Hey, Wicked. Thank you very much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, as always, for tuning in to the Power Hour. I cannot believe we are coming up to the 4-year anniversary of this show. Time really flies. I still love recording these conversations every single week. And I'm so grateful for everyone who tunes in, who listens, who shares. So thanks, everyone. Have an awesome week. And I'm going to be back next week with another episode. And of course, we're doing something very special for the 4-year anniversary of the show. So stay tuned for that as well. See ya.
Up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.